Our parsha is Parshat Ba'alot Cham. The parsha begins with the commandment of the menorah, the special candelabra that was in the temple. The menorah had six branches and one central, really it wasn't a branch, it was the center pole of the menorah. The menorah was lit every night as night fell. According to Maimonides, it was also lit every morning. The menorah is supposed to be made of solid gold. And Chazal say Moshe had a hard time understanding how to do this. This was one thing Moshe didn't know how to do. So according to one medrash, he threw a block of gold into the fire. God said, put it into the fire. And then out came the menorah. It was made miraculously. That's why it's described as Zema'asei ha-menorah. This is how the menorah was done. It doesn't say he did it. Kain asa et ha-menorah. The Torah doesn't identify who. So he made the menorah. Who made the menorah? So that's different opinions as to whether Moshe and Bezalel actually succeeded in this one. Then Moshe is told to inaugurate the Levites. And part of the inauguration, the Levites took a knife and cut off all their hairs, and then they immersed themselves in the mikvah. The Levites are coming instead of the firstborn, meaning initially God had dedicated the firstborn in each family to be representative, to be a servant in the temple. And after they sinned with idol worship, so the Levites were coming in their stead. And just as idol worship is described as defilement, so too he who serves idols is defiled. And even the Levites who are coming instead of the firstborn were defiled to some degree by the worship, by the idol worship of the firstborn. And from here we have the custom that if a person becomes an apostate, if a person joins Christianity or any other religion, so then when they want to do tshuva, they have to shave off all their hair, just as the Levites did, and immerse themselves in a mikvah. In Giyur, when a person wants to convert, so the same holds true. There was an ancient custom that a person converting from another religion would shave off all their hair before going to mikvah. This isn't me'akev. I mean, today many courts don't do this custom anymore. It's not one of the laws of Giyur, but it is a custom that was around up until 100 years ago. It's a new thing that we don't have this custom. So today some courts will say, take a short haircut. That's a commemoration of the custom. But really the ancient custom was to shave off all the hair before going to the mikvah. So the Levites were waved. Very interesting thing. They'd lift the Levites and wave them. Now we have to remember that Moshe is 80 and Aaron is 83, or Moshe is 81 and Aaron's 84, because we're already holding the second year in the desert. So these are old men lifting the Levites. So the Levites are dedicated, and the Levites are there in service. Historically, when the Jews were exiled, so the ones who were exiled most were the Levites, as opposed to the priests, the Kohanim. Meaning, the way the Levite cities were situated in Israel, the Levites were persecuted together with the northern 10 tribes, and when we lost the majority, the millions of Jews from the northern 10 tribes, we also lost the majority of the Levites. And that's why today we have very few Levim compared to Kohanim. Technically, you should have more Levim than Kohanim, because Kohanim are a small segment of the Levites. You have a large tribe of Levites and a small family within that tribe who are the Kohanim. It's one family, the family of Aaron. And yet today you come to an average shul, you can have 6, 8, 10 Kohanim and 1 or 2 Levim. And the reason is because the way their cities were set up, they lived scattered throughout Israel, and they were exiled. When all of Israel, when the northern 10 tribes were exiled, so then a large contingency of the Levites were lost with them. And the Kohanim were around Jerusalem, right. Their cities were closer to Jerusalem, to Benjamin, in the south. You had many more Kohanim there.
Why were there villages of Kohanim and Levim separate? Why wouldn't just Kohanim live where Levim worked? And then, like, all right, when you have your in the Beit HaMikdash, whether you're Kohen or Levi, you're going to get it, you know, based on what the order is. So why would they be living closer to Yerushalayim? Because all they, like, they would just travel, even if they lived in the Negev, or they lived in the Golan, wherever they might live, they would just travel to Jerusalem when it was their turn, no?
It deserves a broader discussion. Discussion of the evolvement of the turns in the Kohanim, the Levites, etc. We have the second Pesach, right? The first Pesach in the desert. And we have people who are impure. And they come to Moshe and Aaron and they say, we are defiled, why should we lose out? And then Moshe says, stick around, let me ask God. And then God gives him the mitzvah of Pesach Sheni, that a person who misses the first Pesach, because they were defiled, can bring the second Pesach. Now, this is a very important concept, the Lama Nigara. Why should we be left out? We see twice in the Torah that there were people who stepped forward and said, we don't want to lose out. And we see that every time someone strives for spirituality and says, I don't want to be left out, great things happen for all of Israel. We see it here, and we'll see it in the end of the book of Bamidbar with the daughters of Tzlafchat. They also will come forward and say, and then the tribe will say, why should our tribe lose a portion in the land of Israel? As we will see there.
Which tribe?
Menashe. We're up to Revi. The Mishkan is built, and a holy cloud settles on the Mishkan by day, and at night there was a vision of fire over the Mishkan. And whenever the Mishkan would rise, so then whenever the cloud would rise, it was a sign that we were traveling. And sometimes they'd spend a long time in one place. Sometimes they spent years in one place. The sign that they were traveling was the fact that the cloud rose. Now, God tells Moshe to prepare two trumpets of silver, solid silver. And we blow those trumpets to gather the people, we blow the trumpets to tell them we're traveling, we blow the trumpets as a part of prayer. And the Torah says those trumpets will also be blown when you offer sacrifices on your days of rejoicing, your holidays, and your Rosh Chodesh. Now, if we mentioned holidays and Rosh Chodesh, so why does the Torah also single out your days of happiness? Which days? We covered Rosh Chodesh and Moed. So the simple understanding is that this is a reference to Shabbos. That's what the Sifri says. And this is the famous source in the Torah that there's a mitzvah to be happy on Shabbos. We know Yom Tov, there's a mitzvah to be happy. Here is a source for a mitzvah to be happy on Shabbos. There's also Jerusalem Talmud that says it. So that's point number one. But there's another interpretation that Ibn Ezra brings. The Ibn Ezra says, if you look at the book of Kings, if you look at the story of Chizkiyahu, we find a few times in Tanakh that when we had a great military victory, the rabbis of the generation instituted a day of rejoicing. And so the Torah is referring to those days of rejoicing, says the Ibn Ezra. Uveyom simchatchem, on the days of your happiness, days that you have instituted to be happy as a way of thanking God for the miracles He has done or the salvations He has given to you, blow your trumpets on your sacrifices, says the holy Al-Sheikh. It is natural that when there's a day of happiness that we can very easily digress and focus on the material aspects of the day. The steak, the mangal, the sleep, the family togetherness. Comes the Torah and stresses, you want to be remembered for good before Hashem. Then on your days of happiness, make sure, blow those trumpets in prayer, bring the sacrifices, and maintain the spirit of the day. It's very easy to take a day of thanks and it becomes a day of emptiness. I'll give you a small example. Many families here in Israel have a custom that on the day that they made Aliyah, they always rejoice. And this custom dates back to Maimonides. In one of Maimonides' letters, he writes that he made it a holiday in his family the day he made Aliyah. And if I remember correctly, Rav Shtori Aparchi, in his famous book, Kaftor Vaferach, writes a similar thing. And if I remember correctly, in the book of the disciple of the Gra, Pa'ata Shulchan, he also brings a similar thing. That the day you make Aliyah, that's a day to rejoice for your whole family. It's not only for you. This is the day you made it. You're zocheh to come here to Israel. I was lucky. I made Aliyah the day after Purim, when a friend of mine got married. So every year I call him to wish him Mazel Tov. I remind him that it's his anniversary. Because I'm celebrating for me. But I, by the way, I remember him too. So the Al-Sheikh says, if you don't take that joy and channel it correctly, it could very easily become an empty, a hollow joy, an external joy. When people get together and celebrate the fact that they made Aliyah, it's a spiritual thing. I don't know of anyone that celebrates. I guess there must be some people. But for most people, coming to Israel was a step down materialistically. I'm saying if you come from the United States, even if you're coming from South America, I don't know the deal in Europe, but to my understanding, for many people in Europe, it's a step down. For some people, it's a step up. Depends on where you're coming from. But for many people, coming to Israel was a step down materialistically. It was a step up spiritually. And people celebrate it, and they're celebrating that step up spiritually. But sometimes what the kids see is that on this day, we go out to a restaurant. On this day, I get cotton candy. On this day, I get a day off of school. They don't see what's behind it. It could very easily evolve into what the Al-Sheikh warns, a day of simple materialistic pleasure, and then you've lost the point. So the Torah comes and says, make sure that on that day you blow your trumpets. Make sure that on that day you offer the sacrifices of thanks, and it is a day of commemoration before Hashem, I am Hashem, your God.
Would you call it, if it's a day of commemoration, specifically, if you celebrate the day you made Aliyah, like year by year, does it then become like what's called a chag, or is chag specifically something that that's like that the Jewish people in general call chag?
Yeah, it's not a chag. It's your Yom Simcha. It's your day of happiness. It's your day of giving thanks. So we
would you say halal without bracha? Is that like possible to do?
You could. Halal is psukim in Tehillim. If a person wants to thank Hashem, those are good psukim to say his thanks. You could say other chapters in Tehillim. You could say whatever you want. I'm saying halal is at the end of the day, it's chapters of Tehillim. You could always say chapters of Tehillim.
But you can't say bracha on that day.
No. We travel. And this is the first time we're traveling. We're leaving the mountain of Sinai. And the mountain of Sinai has tremendous weight in our lives. You'll notice it is described as Moshe Kibel Torah Mi Sinai. Moshe received Torah at Sinai. And in truth, there's much depth to the concept of Sinai. Sinai is not only a mountain. There's much more to that mountain than the fact that physically Moshe went up that mountain to receive the Torah. And Moshe is with the people, and they travel 3 days' journey, and they're happy to leave. As our sages say, it is the tendency of the youth to run out of school. So that's what the Jewish people were like. They were happy to get away from Sinai. Enough. 613. Wow. Whew. Okay. Onward. And this is a poor reflection of the Jewish people. The Torah is showing us our faults. The Torah is indicating a rebuke to the Jewish people. And then the Torah goes on, tells us two psukim, which we'll skip for 1 minute, and tells us that the nation started complaining, and Hashem got upset, and a fire came and killed a lot of people. And then that was the place called Tavera, and then they started having all kinds of desires and saying, we wish we had meat, and we remember the fish of Egypt and all the great vegetation, and this is so tiring, all we have is the man. And the whole story of the nations complaining with their families and God giving them the special slav. What are the two psukim we skipped? The two psukim have an upside down nun. You'll look in a Sefer Torah, you'll see an upside down nun before the two psukim and after the two psukim. And that upside down nun is like parentheses. It's indicating this is a parenthetic remark. This doesn't even belong here. The Torah took two psukim that really belonged elsewhere in the Torah and interjected them here to make a break, to make a pause. You have this whole slew of stories about how we ran away from Torah. We were complaining. We were desiring. We were complaining again. The fire. God wanted to make a break between all the different stories of how bad we were. So God stuck in another two psukim over here, which describe how we travel. When we travel, what did Moshe say? Moshe said, "Arise, Hashem, because when you arise before us, all the enemies scatter." And when we rest, Moshe would say, "Return to our midst, Hashem. Return to the thousands of Israel." Interesting concept. Our traveling, Hashem is scattering the enemies. When we settle, Hashem is settling in between us. These two psukim, 85 letters. Our sages say, the fact that the Torah indicates a pause before and after these two psukim teaches us that these psukim are an embodiment of the whole Torah. Two psukim. Two psukim, 85 letters. From here we derive the halacha that a Sefer Torah that has worn with age or water damage, right? If you pour water on a Sefer Torah, all the ink comes off. So you have a Sefer Torah that is destroyed, but there are 85 letters left. That Sefer Torah has holiness because the minimum amount of letters to sanctify Sefer Torah is this parsha. This is called the, you want to know what a body of Torah is? This is a body of Torah. The Torah has five books. We call them Chumashim because they're Chamisha, Chumshei Torah. Five books of the Torah. The Torah has seven books. Really, the book of Bamidbar is described as three books. The book of Bamidbar prior these two psukim, the book of Bamidbar after these two psukim, and these two psukim stand alone. We treat these two psukim as though they're their own book of the Torah. And halachically, we view the Torah as having seven books, not five books. Generally, we say five books, right? But really, halachically, these two psukim are considered their own book. And if you have a Sefer Torah, as we said earlier, even if God's name isn't there among the 85 letters, if God's name is there, so then the Sefer Torah has holiness even without 85 letters. But without God's name, 85 letters is the minimum amount. That's what we learn from this parasha. So the nation is complaining. And they're complaining about the man. Now, the man was interesting because the man was an indicator of what type of person you were. The Torah describes how the man would fall by their doorstep, and the man would fall out in the camps, and the man would fall out in the desert. So the Talmud asks, which one is it? At the doorstep, in the camp, or out in the desert? So the Talmud says, depends on what kind of guy you were. The pious people, it would fall by their doorstep. If they weren't up to par, you'd have to go into the middle of the camp and find it. And if you were really down and out near Midos, so then it was way out, a person would have to go harvesting until he found his man. So that's a very scary thing. You get a gauge. Think about it. You wake up in the morning and your wife knows what kind of tzaddik you are. Everyone knows. You can't hide. It's like, hey, you know, on your front door there's a sign. You get a 10, you get a 9, you get an 8. It's there. Everyone knows. It says when there were arguments, whether on all kinds of deals, I bought this servant from you, you didn't buy the servant from me. Moshe would say, wait till the morning. God will rule. What did you mean? He'd say, if you get the man for the servant, then God is saying it's your servant. Then that's why you got the extra portion. If he gets the man, it's his servant. When there were arguments about many things, this was an indicator. So it wasn't so pleasant because you never had food for tomorrow. I don't know if you guys can imagine what that means.
They're in the desert.
You're in the desert, 2 million people, and there's no food for tomorrow. So the nation's complaint is understood. On the one end, it's a miraculous way to live. Every day, God is telling you He's with you. On the other end, it's not so pleasant. Every day, you don't have food for tomorrow. You go to sleep at night, and you got to believe God's going to give you food again tomorrow so you can get used to it. I understand. It's still not comfortable. But what was the nation really complaining about? The Torah says they were complaining about their families, and they were saying, we remember when fish were free. Chazal say they spoke about fish, but they weren't talking about fish, they were talking about girls. They were saying, back in Egypt, things were easy. You could pick up a girl, you could have a good time, you could do whatever you want. Now we have a Torah. You got to get married, you got to build a family, you can't go with that, you can't marry any girl you want. Look at Amram, he married his aunt. Comes the Torah and says, no marrying your aunt. Wait a second, but it was a good shidduch, it was nice. Nope, finished. So they got upset over the laws of marriage. Chazal say when we have a mitzvah that we accept with happiness, when we accepted the mitzvah of circumcision with happiness, so for generations we always celebrated Bris Milah. Even people that are very unaffiliated circumcise their kids because we accepted it with happiness. It became a part of us as a happy mitzvah. Marriage is something we were complaining about from day one. The people were complaining about it. Chazal say from that day onward, you never have a marriage without some kind of fight because we accepted it as something we tedious for us. And things that we stood by, even when we were persecuted against them, the Romans, the Greeks, they all decreed you can't circumcise your kid, and the Jewish people were willing to give up their lives for it. So till today, we're strong in those mitzvot. Other mitzvot which people relax about, and when there were decrees against them, people didn't do them so well, like tefillin. So then, till today, not everyone puts on tefillin, and it's a lax mitzvah in Am Yisrael. So Moshe says, how am I going to handle these people? And God says, watch, we'll do it together. And now we have the beginning of a broad discussion about whether Judaism espouses democracy or a monarchy. What's going on here with establishing 70 leaders? Were there really 71 leaders? Was Moshe just a part of a democracy? Was there a board of directors for the Jewish people? That was Moshe's concern. And we will discuss Be'ezrat Hashem tomorrow night how God ensured that Moshe would have the leadership and the assistance of the 70 elders. That's where we'll pick up Be'ezrat Hashem tomorrow.